There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast that is a roundup of the best bits of today's show from Monday, the 2nd of March.
Did you see it?
Oh, I was there. I took the selfie, bought the t-shirt, and I'm still glowing this morning.
Glowing is probably the right word. If you were in the downtown area last night at around 8:45, you may have noticed two things. Number one, a bunch of DubaiEye or Virgin or Dubai 92 or Radio Shoma or any of our many other station staff, breakfast presenters, running around feeling a bit excited, and a giant skyscraper with our name all over it.
Yeah, this was, look, shameless marketing plug, but last night our parent company, the Arabian Radio Network, took over the Burj Khalifa. For about 3 minutes, all of our logos were broadcast over the Burj Khalifa. And look, we know others have done it. It's a
thing. Not another media company, though.
Never another media company. We are the first media company to do it, to take over the Burj Khalifa. And it's really cool. So we all went down there. We had a big shindig down at the Address Downtown Hotel at their new Bar Zeta, which is really cool, overlooking the fountains and the Burj Khalifa. And then it lit up with, as you said, the 9, 10 radio stations of this network, us, Virgin, City 1016, etc. And we had our 7 or 8 seconds of fame. And it was really cool. I felt quite important.
We had our 7 or 8 seconds of fame before Virgin had its 7 or 8 seconds of fame. I'm just going to point that out there. Who is this Chris Fade of whom you speak?
I can neither confirm nor deny. Big shout out to our boss, Mahmoud Al-Rashid, who pulled that deal off. Shukran Jazeela, Mahmoud. But it was a nice thing. Look, it's a corporate thing. We're like, you're driving to work this morning. You work for an organization. You've got to make a buck. We make our money through advertising. So we do these things to make a splash. We invite all our clients. We had the Dress Downtown guys looked after us very, very well. Top notch. Can I admit something?
Maybe, yeah. 8 past 6, go for it.
8 past 6. Because this Zeta bar where we had, there was a couple of hundred of us down there, and they had loads of really good food, including a shawarma stand.
How many did you eat?
I took 2 home.
You don't carry a handbag. How did you
secrete? Because I had my laptop with me. So I had my man bag with me and I took 2 shawarmas home and gave one to the wife.
You're so romantic.
I know.
No wonder your marriage is flourishing.
It was her birthday last week.
It's a slightly squashed shawarma that I picked up half an hour ago.
Don't worry, I'll put it in the microwave. It's a bit cold, but I'll put it in the microwave. Anyway, that's just between us.
That's lovely. Who got the other one? The pug?
Me. Oh, the pugs were very interested, but no, there was too many pickles.
I can actually attest that whenever we go out for corporate digs and I end up driving Richard home, he does insist on going through the McDonald's drive-thru in order to get the wife a happy meal.
Or eat and drink or something like that. But that's not the reason we were there. We were there.
Who needs a dozen roses?
It's so old hat. But I tell you, it's interesting because if you think back to the birth of DubaiEye, and I was there at the beginning and you were there very close to the beginning.
19 years this month, by the way. Did you realise? I was talking to Robbie and Chris last night who did not know that it is corporately our birthday in March. 19 years.
For DubaiEye?
For the ARN as a group.
Okay, yeah. Arabian Radio Network, the parent company. Although, to be fair, corporate history in Dubai, if you have a long memory. When I moved here in the late 90s, basically it was Dubai, 92 FM was kind of the radio station that you listened to. There were one or two others, but that was the mm-hmm. default. And that's what's become Dubai 92, which is kind of bedrock of this network. And that's what I listened to, you know, people like Jason Lumber, Mark Lloyd, you know, Jason's sadly no longer with us, but Mark Lloyd is. These were stalwarts of the Dubai Airways in the 1990s.
They had vinyl.
And it morphed into the Arabian Radio Network and suddenly became this, and went from being, honestly, when we joined about 15 years ago, a bit of a kind of ragtag collection of radio stations, to now being
which
this.
Which is the reason we managed to get our foot in the door.
Honestly, they wouldn't hire us now. But it, and then through the good offices of far better people than you and I, it kind of morphed over a decade or so into what is genuinely, you know, one of the region's leading media companies in radio and digital and outdoor and so many other ways. And it just kind of happened. I don't remember. There wasn't a day when it changed from being a slightly ragtag collection of radio stations into being this regional stroke global media giant. But it did. And last night, seeing the logos up there on the Burj Khalifa just reminds you how far we've come. And to be fair, that probably mirrors quite a lot of companies in Dubai. If you look at the we're quasi-government, we're part of Dubai Holding now. We weren't then, but we are now. Quasi-government or big family trading firm-owned companies that were back in the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, there was an element of cottage industry about them, which was charming and good, and it worked. But they have professionalized and they have evolved over that time. And we've been part of that wider Dubai stroke UAE story. And last night kind of drove it home to me.
Oh, that's really sweet. I'm still getting over the shawarmas in the MEMPEG.
that was wrong. I'm not proud.
What would that mean for your general fitness, however, in terms of how many... So tell me something. How many times a week do you get a takeout? Or a delivery, more likely now?
Oh, I'm going to say 4.
Oh, my goodness. You're not even... That's not even listed here as an option. I'm having a look at some research that's come out from Zurich. And we're going to be speaking... The insurance people, we're going to be speaking from a little bit later in the show. And they're having a look at, first of all, what's going to kill us. And secondly, how healthy and fit we all are. How many times a week do you exercise?
About the same 4.
Really?
Yeah.
Walking in and out of this building doesn't count as a gym session.
No, I joined a gym a while ago. I'd say... 4.
Yeah. Okay, all 4. Right. Okay, yeah. You're doing okay then. Let me tell you some of the statistics. 61% of us get a delivery or we eat out once or twice a week. I'm definitely in that category. 55% of us exercise more than once a week. Only 16% of us exercise daily. I'd just like to say at this point, I walked to work this morning. Thank you very much.
That's impressive.
35% of us haven't been for a general checkup in over a year. That's me.
No, I've been.
Did they find anything?
It's a crop. They didn't actually. A clean bill of health, which was amazing.
And yet, 90% of us consider ourselves healthy. So despite the fact that we're exercising once a week or less, and the Deliveroo guy's ringing the bell twice a week or more, the majority of us are like, yeah, totally, I'm healthy.
Yeah, I mean, I know I'm carrying, you know, 5 extra kilos at the moment. That I shouldn't be. I've got maybe 12 pairs of jeans in my wardrobe or trousers, 2 of which I can wear.
I'm getting there. I'm going down.
Can we talk about your plan and B, your progress so far?
We can't talk about my plan, but we can talk about my progress so far.
Okay, fine. So far this year, Brandy has shed
5 kilograms, including 2.5 on holiday,
which is on an all taco diet is frankly astonishing.
I set myself a couple of goals at the beginning of 2020, and I am on track, as Shruti, our producer, knows, to hit them. I am working on them well.
We're certainly not talking about the second goal.
Right, but speaking of health, very seriously, a couple of minutes. We are today focusing on the coronavirus as well. Obviously, making headlines every single morning. We've got a couple of guests in who are going to be putting some different perspectives on it this morning. One of the things we're going to be looking at is business travel. Companies in the UK now starting to tell people to work from home, particularly if they have had staff that have come back from areas with outbreaks. Chevron, for example, in its London office has told 300 people to work from home because someone apparently came back from Italy and then developed flu-like symptoms. OMG, massive media group again in London. 1,000 employees have been told to work from home because they had a staff member who had been through Singapore who, again, was throwing symptoms. We've heard on this program that working from home is possibly going to increase during this period. We're going to have Mercer, the HR people, in the studio to talk to us about the difficult decisions that HR departments are making at the moment. At what point do you decide to put in a travel ban? How wide do you stretch it? Can you stop people going on holiday? If one of your staff says, you know, I'm going away for 3 weeks, I'm going to Thailand, I'm going to Bali, I'm going to wherever, I'm flying through Singapore, can you actually say, no, you're not?
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
One of the things that those markets are, of course, reacting to is the coronavirus. A lot of sectors impacted, including travel. We are looking now at the difficult decisions that HR departments around the world are having to make when it comes to restricting travel on the back of the virus. What do they need to weigh up? We're very pleased to be joined in the studio by Nuno Gomes, who is the regional head of careers at the HR Experts Mercer. Nuno, it's lovely to have you back in. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're hearing so much about big name multinationals, international firms restricting travel or restricting all but essential business travel. What are we actually seeing here in the UAE?
So I think here in UAE, we're seeing a similar trend. I think it's obviously early days to identify a clear pattern of what is happening, but essentially, you know, both the multinationals operating in this part of the world as well as local companies are following suit to what they're seeing in other parts of the world, especially the trends coming from Asia, but how the Western markets and the mature markets are reacting to it. So essentially, we're seeing, you know, companies obviously restricting all travel to most affected areas like China, South Korea, and Italy. Also restricting all non-essential business travel, but not really totally canceling it, with a few exceptions that we have seen companies actually totally terminating all international travel. But also, you know, making sure that they make employees comfortable in terms of making their own plans. If they really do not want to travel, be able to give them that option not to do so.
What kind of decisions then need to be made in HR, and how are they made? What factors do HR departments need to weigh up here?
I think this is a particularly delicate one, because I think there is a fine balance between the business need and the employee or the personal need. Obviously, their businesses continue to operate. We need to make sure they remain healthy, and we are addressing our clients' needs as well as our business needs. But there is a personal component here. So that's really where HR, not really HR, but business leaders as well, need to make those decisions to weigh in the two components. And let's not forget that there is an awful lot of emotional stress at this point in time. It's not just people worried about their business, worried about if the stocks of their companies are going down, if they're fulfilling their client needs, but also about their families. You know, are there, you know, if their kids get a fever, you know, immediately there's a lot of a tremendous amount of personal stress, psychological stress, that I think HR departments as well as business leaders need to take into account and be flexible enough to allow for people to be comfortable while we navigate through these uncertain times.
But very uncertain times that are changing on a daily basis. I mean, Richard's just reminded me that a week ago he sent me an email saying, hey, do you mind if I disappear in April to Italy for a week? He wouldn't necessarily be sending that email without thinking several times about it this morning.
I'm looking at it Sunday, 23rd of February, because, you know, we can't be away at the same time. Hey, I hope you're having fun. A quick one. Planning to ask for the first week in Ramadan off to go to the Milan Design Fair. Is that all okay with you? Sunday, April the 26th. And you wrote back saying, yeah, it's fine. Seemed like the perfectly normal thing to do on the 23rd of February. Now it seems ludicrous. Of course, the design fair has been postponed since then. These things are moving so quickly, Nuno.
Absolutely. And I think that's a key point, is to really remain nimble and flexible at this point in time, and we're seeing that. I mean, we're seeing that with major events. You mentioned the fashion show in Milan. We're seeing conferences being canceled or postponed for the most part, really around the world. We're now talking about football matches in Europe being at closed doors or even postponed. So I think really monitoring things even on a daily basis, be able to react quickly, and I think really taking that perspective that even if businesses do suffer, businesses or any other type of economic impact happens on a very short term, but we're actually dealing with a much larger scale problem. And I think if we look at how some of the places that were more quickly affected, for example, Singapore and Hong Kong, have actually managed to, for the most part, contain the issue. I think looking at some of those examples, especially Singapore, how they dealt with that, is probably a good example for us to try and replicate.
What about personal travel? What about holidays? Can a company stop you from taking a holiday at the moment, traveling for a holiday?
I think that's as much a legal question as it is an HR one. I think, from my personal perspective, I do not think employers can restrict personal travel, can restrict vacation. I have one of my team members on vacation right now. I mean, I don't think we can prevent people from taking vacation. I think they need to be aware of the risks. They need to be aware of wherever they are, what are the implications eventually coming back. So I think this is where things like business resilience and being prepared, people taking away their personal and professional laptops to be able to work from any other part of the world in case they can come back for their workplace, for example, are policies that are important to reinforce at this point in time and make sure we can continue to do business even if in a different mode if people can't really come back.
Well, speaking of which, we've got 1 minute left with you. Big report in the New York Times this morning about US and UK companies encouraging people to work from home. Are you starting to see that here?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think this is perhaps we are leaving the greatest flexible working from home experiment in the history of the world. I think it is forcing us to see how effective and efficient some of these measures can be. I think one way or another, especially if you look in places like Hong Kong, for example, people had to work from home for weeks now in a row. So I think we're seeing that come here as well. And it's probably really going to test if a lot of these things that we have been and businesses have been resilient, have been resistant to, can really prosper also in this part of the world.
Nuno Gomes, Head of Careers at the HR Experts Mercer for this region. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you very much.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Size Business Breakfast.
I'm half a latte in this morning. I'll be two down by the end of this show and in a much better mood than when I started. And my story of the day today, forget the virus, forget global supply chains, forget market carnage. I want to talk about coffee subscriptions.
This could revolutionise our morning brew.
It is, and it's a bigger story than just me and one almond milk latte, although if anyone wants to turn up at the studio with another one, I will gladly take it. Because our lives are becoming subscriptionised. Music, television, food delivery boxes for a lot of people. Is coffee next? Panera is a bakery come cafe chain, national, in the US. They bake their own bread. They make a lot of salads. They also sell coffee. And they have launched what is America's first nationwide coffee subscription. For $8.99 a month, you can get unlimited hot drip coffee, hot tea, iced coffee, light roast, dark roast, hazelnut, iced or decaf, as long as you sign up.
This seems like almost too good to be true, but they're going to make the profit, well, on two things. One, as you point out, Brandy, the profit margins, the net profit margin on a cup of coffee is massive. You pay $3 for the cup of coffee. 10 cents is the cost of the beans and the hot water, the rest you're paying for the staff, the rent, the lighting and so on and so forth. So there's enough margin in a cup of coffee to do that. The second thing is that the percentage of secondary spend, the percentage of people who, when they have a subscription, buy a donut or a muffin. And it's a big number, isn't it?
Yeah, they did a trial. So they trialed it over 3 months and they found two really interesting things. Number one, 90% of the people in the trial kept signing up month after month for those 3 months. 70% of them, when they went in and got their, well, it's not free, is it? But, virtually free coffee, bought something else to go with it. They also visited the stores three times more than people who didn't have a coffee subscription. So they're coming in more often, they're buying a croissant to go with the coffee, and they're resubscribing. So we know it could work for the chains. Would it work for the people, though? Having a look at the maths, an investment company called Acorn reckons your average American spends $92 a month on coffee. If we take the average price here in Dubai as being arguably 18 dirhams. If you have one coffee a day here, and I'd call that light usage, that's 360 dirhams for 20 days a month. So we assume you just do it on work days, right? You brew, you know, you make your own at home during the weekend. That's 360 dirhams. This 8.99 subscription for a month, 36 dirhams, is one-tenth of what you'd be paying normally. I would absolutely sign up.
Well, you're not the only one. Jyoti's written in saying, I spend about 100 dirhams a week on posh coffee. I would snatch your hand off, says Jyoti, for a 50 dirham coffee subscription. To be honest, I don't buy posh coffees on a daily basis at work. I read the book that said, if you invest that money in a tracker fund rather than Starbucks, Costa, Cafe Nero, whatever, you can retire by the age of 60, blah, blah, blah. So I don't buy posh coffee. I just make it at the coffee machine here. A posh coffee is a weekend treat rather than a daily basis. But honestly, for $8.99 a month, I'm going to start on the posh coffees.
Well, and that's the point, because the Panera research, they found that 50% of people felt guilty about their coffee spend. They were spending it, but they were feeling bad about it. And we know that it's one of the things that people do cut during recessionary times, during tighter times. So if you effectively take it down to 30 cents a cup, a couple of dirhams, you're actually going to increase the amount of people who are buying coffee, let alone everything else.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Let's talk insurance now and healthy lifestyles. Joined in the studio by the chief executive for the Middle East of Zurich Insurance Company, Walter Jopp. Walter, good morning. Good to see you.
Good morning, Richard. Great to see you guys too.
New research out of Zurich shows there has been an increase in claims in this region for two things in particular: life insurance cover and critical illness cover. Tell us in particular what's causing people to unfortunately die or face these critical illnesses, and what impact is it having on the insurance industry?
I think it's important to state that people have died all throughout history. Yeah, so that's not a new trend. I think what we're doing is increasing awareness. So we were the first company to release our claim stats, and what we want to do is try and educate our customers for the need for protection. So what we've done in our latest set of claim statistics is over the last 3 years, we've seen a 9% increase of claims paid to $111 million. And we are seeing on the life cover side, we are seeing an increased trend due to heart attack and strokes. And on the critical illness side, we're seeing cancer being as the main driver. And a lot of this, Richard, is down to lifestyle, health benefits. We're very fortunate to live in this wonderful country that we do, but we have great food, we have lovely cars, we have air conditioning. So getting out and exercising, and I did enjoy hearing Brandy walk into work today, because actually it's taking that time to be fit and healthy. What we want to do is educate people that if you look after yourself, you will actually, you can minimise your risks of getting one of these lifestyle diseases, and you will live longer.
So the insurance statistics show that those are the big three: heart attacks, strokes and cancer. And of course, not all of those by any means are all lifestyle related, but a good proportion are. So for us as people, but for you as an insurance company, it's in everyone's best interest, because you don't want to be paying out on these things, that people look after themselves better.
At Zurich, we do want to pay claims, and that's why we publish our claim stats. Yeah, so we pay 96% of our life cover claims and 94% of our critical illness. We want to do that. But what we want is fitter, happier, healthier customers. And what we want to do is use our statistics to educate customers so that they know that they can do certain things. Have regular checkups. Be fit and healthy. Eat well. You know, none of this is rocket science. We do know that if you look after yourself, you can actually minimise the risks.
So, in terms of the insurance industry and how many people are getting this kind of cover, Zurich is a significant player globally in this industry and in this region. To what extent are we seeing the rate of insurance increasing in this region? Traditionally, we have been very underinsured, whether it comes to our house contents or our life or critical illness. We just have in this region. Are we seeing any changes in that across the board, Walter?
We're seeing a slow change across that. The insurance penetration in the Middle East is very, very low by global standards. So it's around 1%. We know that in other developed...
1% of?
1% insurance. So 1% of the population thinks about buying insurance. So it's very, very low. The actual global mature market penetration rate is circa 10%. And the global average is 3%. So we've got a long way to go for people to think about themselves insuring against their critical illnesses or the life cover. And in this region, it's particularly important, Richard, because if something happens to the main breadwinner, if something happens to the visa holder, your family will have to relocate and probably have to move somewhere else, and that's going to cost, and you need some money to do that.
And you say not only do we have an issue with not enough people are insured, but they're also insuring themselves for not enough money. For example, you say that the vast majority, over 90% of critical illness claims, were insured for $250,000 or less, which sounds like a lot of money, but you say actually when times are really, really bad, you can burn through $250,000, not quickly, but it doesn't last forever.
So if you think about the average age at which people are claiming, so that it's around the age of 50. So life expectancy is about 80, 85 years old, depending on which country you come from. So therefore, you're going to have to live for 35 years. Your family, your loved ones are going to have to, they're going to have to go to university. They're going to have to potentially buy a house somewhere. $250,000 is, I would argue, not enough to be able to do that over a 30-year period.
So what's the solution?
The solution is looking after yourself, doing exercise, getting yourself treated, and protecting yourself and your loved ones. Go and see a financial advisor. If you don't want to see a financial advisor, go on one of the many websites that you can go on and try and work out how much life cover you need. And that is important, right? Nobody wants to think about getting ill. Nobody wants to think about dying. But actually, looking after yourself, your loved ones is very, very important. And if you do get a critical illness, so the great news is, if you get cancer, for example, survival rates are higher than ever. But actually, your lifestyle may need to change. You might not be able to do the job that you were doing before. You might have to do something else, a less stressful job or whatever. So all that, you can, if you have the financial means to do so, you can actually change your lifestyle and actually live a long and healthy life beyond that.
Walter, great talking to you as ever. Appreciate you joining us this morning. Walter Yop, Chief Executive Officer for Zurich Insurance Company in the Middle East. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Richard.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.